if you want to be a guest, please email me. I have received so many emails of people that are excited and passionate about being a guest on this show. The process is time consuming. I go through about an hour long pre-interview and I determine where you'd fit best in the season. So if you've gone through the pre-interview process, or we've messaged back and forth via email and haven't gone through the pre-interview process, I'm not ignoring you. I promise. There's just a lot on my plate and I am one person. So that being said, I look forward to talking with every one of you that is interested in being on this podcast. Y'all are amazing and I honestly could not do this podcast without the support that I receive from each one of you. So thank you so much.
And it's like that verse is like comforting and also upsetting at the same time.
Exactly.
Like being able to trust God is a really comforting feeling. But this idea that you can't lean on your own understanding is hard, because then it's like, well, then I always struggled with that. And I think I still do in some ways now. It's like, well, this idea of intellectual humility is really an important one.
Yeah.
But then how do you know if you're hearing from God, so to speak? Or how do you know if you're getting it right? Especially when it seems like there are, for every verse, there are so many different opinions about how to see things. And I sometimes felt like I was not supposed to trust my own gut, my own intuition. Like, even when it was very powerful, I was not supposed to rely on that. I was supposed to rely on scripture, but really often that meant like the church's interpretation of scripture. And so, talking again about mixed messages, you know.
Welcome to the Focus on Your Own Family podcast. Fundamentalist evangelicalism impacted a generation. We survived physical, psychological, mental, and spiritual abuse. We survived the Focus on the Family movement, and we want to talk about it. Trigger warning, guests will be sharing stories of domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse. Please listen with caution. This is Sarah. Here is her story. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to talk with you.
Same. So you have been doing back-to-back-to-back-to-back interviews. How are you doing? That's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's great to, that's what you would, it's a good problem to have, I guess, when you write a book, you want people to be interested in it. But I have been busy. So, but I love talking to people. It's been really fun figuring out sort of different people key into different aspects of the book. And, I'm excited to talk to you, I'm sure, about Focus on the Family and other things.
Y'all, I have Sarah McCammon and I am so excited. I received an advanced reader's edition a few months ago. And Sarah, this is a wonderful book. It reads almost like a memoir, but from a journalist perspective. So you have a wealth of information in here. And I also hear the vulnerability in your writing. And I love that those two are intertwined, because it feels personal and educational. And I think it's going to cross over that border of talking to the people that grew up like this. It's really going to be able to hit people that are kind of interested in this. Like, okay, what was up with those neighbors that I live next door to that were kind of strange? Right. This will answer a lot of those questions without getting too much into the weeds that only people that grew up like this would necessarily understand. So it's just beautifully packaged, and congratulations on all your success. You're a New York Times bestseller. That's a really big deal.
Yeah, I feel very grateful. I'm very pleased. And I appreciate you saying all of that, because I really wanted, with this book, I was seeing so much dialogue around deconstruction and around like what it means to be evangelical, especially in this moment. And what I always say is that I think it's not just, all of this is not just about Donald Trump, but I do think that his movement and his alliance with evangelicalism has catalyzed a lot of conversations for people, a lot of sort of self-reflection about what that label really means. And I wanted to, with writing this, I wanted to paint a really specific and granular picture of what it's like to be evangelical and how evangelicals think, with the caveat that, you know, everybody's a little bit different. But I wanted to give people on the outside a real sense of that, a flavor of that. And I didn't want it to just be my story, though, because while I have this weird sort of intersection of my personal and professional life, where I end up, I've wound up covering white evangelicals kind of accidentally as a journalist, I also have this deep, deep background in that world. And so I understand the culture and the language and the thinking. And so I wanted to sort of speak to people who are scratching their heads, like trying to make sense of evangelicalism. But I also wanted to speak to people like us who grew up in that world. And as I have paid attention the last several years to these ex-evangelical and deconstruction spaces, I find some really common experiences and unifying themes. And I wanted to write something that would kind of weave all of that together. So I appreciate what you said about that.
Yeah, you did do just a wonderful job. For those that do not know, it's called The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And thank you for making that distinction. I always tell people, I speak from the perspective of growing up white evangelical, because Black evangelical culture is very different.
If you look at, polling data, Black Christians and white Christians, and obviously there are other categories of Christians as well, but just talking about those two groups, vote very, very, very differently, even if they may hold similar theological views. So I felt it was, some people have gotten angry about white in the subtitle, like, why are you being racist? I've heard that. And I'm like, I'm not being racist. I'm just trying to be specific about what I'm talking about. And I have, I have heard from several Black Christians who've told me that aspects of this book resonate with them too, because, churches have some overlap and there's certainly cross-pollination. But I didn't want to speak out of school. I wanted to talk about, the world that I grew up in, which was overwhelmingly white.
Yeah. So, question. On page 35, you talk about how your parents, like you heard your mom say that you were the strong-willed child. Mm-hmm. If you don't mind taking me back, taking the listeners back to your childhood, who was Sarah prior to hearing that she was a strong-willed child? And what did that label say to you as the person that you were at the time?
Well, we had that book by James Dobson, of course, The Strong-Willed Child, in our house. And I just remember my mom saying, Sarah's strong-willed. And, I don't think I asked what that meant, but I had the sense that it was a bad thing, that it meant, something like disobedient or combative, or in some way, not what they wanted me to be. I mean, they had a whole book about how to fix it, right? Mm-hmm. So, that it felt like a negative label. And as I write, it also felt kind of confusing, because I was a really compliant kid, as I remember. I mean, I was a firstborn. I had a lot of responsibility for my siblings. I had three younger siblings. And so, I was not complaining about this, but just to paint a picture, mm-hmm. we'd go out in public and somebody needed to use the bathroom and be, Sarah, can you take your sister to find the bathroom? Sure. I'd go do that. I would be told, you are the oldest. You need to set an example for your younger siblings. You need to behave well. And I found that sometimes that felt like a lot of pressure, but it also in a way felt like an honor, like an important responsibility. And I was, I went to Christian school. I always got good grades. I always did my homework. I was a student that the teachers really liked having in school. And, nobody seemed to have a problem with me, but I was still, in some way, I was still seen as this strong-willed child that I guess, and I can't go back and remember what those moments were like, so I don't know what it was that they were picking up on. I was always very verbal and curious. Maybe that's why I became a journalist. My mom would sometimes tell this story about me, and I don't remember this incident at all, but like, apparently they were supposed to go on a hot air balloon ride when I was four with a friend. And I don't know what I did, but I guess I had a temper tantrum or something, but my mom would tell the story about how like I wouldn't behave. And so they had to cancel the hot air balloon ride and both she and I had to stay behind. And whenever I would hear that, I heard that story a couple times when I was pretty little. And again, I didn't remember that incident, but I remember hearing her talk about it. And I just remember feeling really ashamed. Like I there was something wrong with me. I ruined this day for myself and my mom. Man, that would have been cool if I'd gone on a hot air balloon ride. I never got to do that. And I don't know why this seems important to me, but it was just a story about me that I was told about myself that I think made me feel like I was in some way not what I was supposed to be. And of course, I'm a parent now. I have two teenagers, not little anymore. And so I know that 3 and 4 year old kids have bad days and they misbehave and they throw fits for, you know, any number of things could have been going on. Who knows what was going on that day? And yeah, maybe not going on the hot air balloon ride was the right call. I might've made the same call too, if I thought my kid was so out of sorts, they were going to be a problem. But I just tell that story because it's like, I just always had this sense about me that somehow I wasn't, you know, I wasn't measuring up and I didn't quite know why.
What's interesting about that though, is I have many stories that are like that, that I could say that, you know, my parents would tell me growing up, that was a very common thing and it was a very common thread throughout families that were raised or parents that raised their kids on Dobson. And I think it's because Dobson, the way that he wrote about children, he made it seem like children, when they are born, they're like tiny little adults. And he placed the expectation that adults should have on them. He placed that on children. And it was the parents' job to guide them, to steer them, to control them into that way of life. Like, what I'm saying by that is, when I was three, my parents had the expectation that I would reason like they would, like an adult. Mm-hmm. And we just, mm-hmm. we had that on our shoulders from the very, very beginning. So we weren't allowed to make mistakes ever.
Yeah. I talk in the book about, you know, quote unquote, getting saved at 2.5. Like I repeated the salvation prayer and I have it like written. I talk about this little purple Bible, which is right behind me in this room that I'm in right now. And it's written, scrawled in there I got the Bible when I was 10. So I wrote this down years later, but the lore was that I had gotten saved when I was 2.5. And I wrote, you know, saved age 2.5 in my little 10-year-old handwriting. And it's like the thought that a 2.5-year-old can make any kind of sophisticated spiritual or theological decision is nuts to me now. You know, I mean, I had my kids at that age were pretty verbal too, and could have easily prayed a prayer with me if I told them it would save them from burning in hell forever. But what does that mean? I mean, you know, but just to your point, like the thought that children were very sophisticated and responsible for their eternal destiny at this age, let alone their behavior on the day that they're going to go ride in a hot air balloon. It was just kind of built into the culture.
Exactly. We were not allowed to be children. We had to be little adults. We had to embody all that was being the next generation for Jesus. We were an extension of our parents. We were an extension of our pastors. We were an extension of our leaders. And ultimately an extension for what they wanted God to look like. It prevented us from, like I said, just being able to be a kid in that moment and having a hard day and not wanting to go on a hot air balloon ride. That's okay if 1 minute you don't want to go and you're having a bad day. And then 5 minutes later, all of a sudden, I'm okay, now I want to go. But the way they decided to paint you in that moment, she's a strong-willed child. And it's... We weren't allowed to make mistakes.
I don't want to bash my mom by telling that story. I mean, I don't intend to. Like, I know how hard it is to parent and how frustrating and exhausting toddlers can be. And I'm sure it was hard for her. I'm sure it was a huge disappointment for her. And maybe because of the way that she was being shaped by some of this evangelical culture, maybe it also felt like a failure on her part. Like, my kid would be more holy if I were parenting the right way. I may be totally putting words in her mouth, but I could imagine one steeped in all of those materials feeling like, well, my child's a sinner. I believe that. And I believe that there's a formula for literally beating the sin out of them. And if I haven't, you know, if they keep sending, I guess I have to keep at it because I haven't gotten there yet. You know, I don't know, but I think my parents, obviously they made choices about how they parented and what influences they absorbed. So I don't mean to totally let them off the hook, but I also think parenting is hard. Toddlers really suck sometimes. And we're all shaped by the influences around us. So that was what was shaping them.
I think that you do well in this book is no, you don't let your parents off the hook. I think that you do a good job in the book of saying, I recognize where this started and why this started. And I hold space and I hold compassion. In the book, page 55, in the world and not of it, I hear the vulnerability in your young adult teenage self wishing that you had the worldly experience and equally proud of yourself for holding the line. Proud of the persecution and shame for lack of knowledge, you say, in those moments, I couldn't help but feel a little superior, never having done anything that would cause me anxiety about missing a period or vomiting on a clergyman. But I also felt like I had never done anything. I tried to be friendly, but I often felt like I didn't really know how to talk to these people. I missed home. I didn't fit. And they knew it too. Wow, I related to that so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken me a long time. I'm 43 years old now, and I still sometimes feel in the quote unquote secular world like a fish out of water. And I think as I've gotten older, I've also realized that most people feel like an outsider sometimes. And, you know, there are all kinds of reasons why people feel like they don't fit in. So that's not really unique, but it was specific in a certain way to our evangelical background, I guess. And yeah, I'm talking about the semester I think that I spent as a Senate page in DC. I was for one semester working in Washington. It was the only time I'd ever been away from home for any real length of time and around a lot of other kids from a variety of religious backgrounds. And I just realized how, you know, really profoundly how different I was. And to your point, yes, it was a complicated set of feelings because I'd been taught that we would be persecuted for righteousness, right? That we would be ostracized for our beliefs. And so I expected that. And in a way, when, you know, one of my roommates made fun of me for reading the Bible, which by the way was rude and she shouldn't have done that. Speaking even as a, you know, much, much less religious person today. I just think that isn't nice and we should be nice. But we were teenagers, and teenagers sometimes aren't nice. But, you know, when my roommate made fun of me, I felt hurt and embarrassed. But also, yes, I felt proud. It was like, well, look, I'm doing the thing that I'm supposed to do as a Christian. I'm being unashamed of the gospel. I am standing up for my beliefs. And I did. I would look at my friends who were my classmates who had some of whom had had sexual experience and feel really intrigued and kind of titillated and jealous of that in a way, but also very judgy of it, you know, like, well, I don't do that and maybe I would like to, but I don't have the problems that they have. And you know, now again, as an adult and a parent, I can see like the value of caution around these things and of, you know, of being prudent. And you know, I think swinging completely the other direction isn't advisable either, but for me, there was this real sense that we had the right way to do things and we were doing things the right way, and therefore we were better. But also of sometimes missing out on doing the quote unquote wrong things because those things seem to be pretty normal for other teenagers.
How did you come to that space of not labeling them wrong, but just different?
Very slowly over time. And I think I've tried to be careful again about as I relax the way I label things, I don't want to fall into the other ditch, right? Like
Yeah.
I mean, I think, and I've seen some criticism on social media of ex-evangelicals critiquing purity culture. I saw one particular post on X recently that was essentially saying, look, well, how can ex-evangelicals critique purity culture when they've also seen the excesses of the sexual revolution, the ways that has hurt women? I'm paraphrasing here, but that was the essence of the post. And I think that's a false dichotomy. It's not like our choice is either no sex till marriage, maybe only courtship. You barely know the person, you know nothing about your body. You're shamed for masturbating, so you don't even know what turns you on or how to, you know, experience sexual satisfaction. All those things that happen for a lot of people in purity culture in various ways. It's not like it's that or nothing but hookup culture, meaningless sex, promiscuity, you know, and I'm not judging anybody who wants to have meaningless, promiscuous sex. That's such a personal decision, what you do with your own body. And that's, I think mm-hmm. that's between people and God, if they believe in God, or certainly between just themselves and themselves. But I accept the critique that not everything about the sexual revolution has necessarily worked out great for women. I mean, I think I know plenty of people who want to be in meaningful relationships and are not, and find casual sex at a certain point unsatisfying. That's not everybody, but that exists. And so I accept that critique is a valid one for some people, but I don't think that those are our only options, right? Like, I've tried to raise my boy. I have two boys, and I have tried to raise them with an understanding that sex is important. It's meaningful. At its best, it's shared with somebody that you really love and feel connected to and have, you know, an emotional connection, an intellectual connection, and also a physical connection. But that I also, you know, have tried to raise them with the understanding that, like, they're probably going to have sex before they get married at some point with somebody that they might not get married to. Like, that's statistically very likely and very normal. And it's important that that be done respectfully and consensually and thoughtfully and with health in mind. But like, there, to have these two ditches on either side, I think is really dangerous. And, you know, with freedom comes responsibility, right? And I feel like, especially around sex, it's been important to think about both of those things. And it's taken me a long time to think through it and figure out, you know, what I think. But I've really just tried to, I talk about my own children because I think what you tell your children is really indicative of what you value and think is important. And I've tried to just give them as much honest, non-judgmental advice as I can. But I have said, like, you don't want to have a baby before you finish your education. You know, you don't want to get a girl pregnant accidentally if you can possibly avoid it. And there are ways to avoid that, just because it's not good for you or for her. And you need to be totally sure that you're both consenting to everything and that this is what you want and that you're ready for it. And that's how I talk to my kids. It's much more nuanced. It is not go do whatever you want, but it's also not, oh my gosh, if you cross this particular line, you're going to destroy your life and destroy your relationships. Because I think that message is very damaging for a lot of people.
It's very true. I was talking with a girlfriend last night about that. How do we, based on how we were raised, how do we talk to our kids about that? How do I talk to my daughter about that versus how do I talk to my boys about that? Mm-hmm. And talking to my boys about consent, talking to my daughter is not really at that age at all. She's not a teenager, but my two boys are teenagers. And so being very practical about that and also allowing them the freedom to be able to talk about it, because I was not allowed to talk about it whatsoever. We did not talk about sex in our home, period. It was very shameful. Even after I was married, still not okay. It was wrong.
I think my parents, like, I appreciate the fact that they, you know, they would sometimes flirt with each other, and my dad would make jokes about, you know, how he was attracted to my mom, and it was nothing like over the top gross. It was just kind of cute. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that. You know, I think that that was healthy to see that modeled for me. So I am thankful that I had like a notion of sex within marriage being a good thing. But it was so limited to that. And I think there was, you know, I remember as I was getting older and, you know, obviously, you know, you hit puberty, you have feelings, your body develops, you know, you become aware of your sexuality, and, having like that awareness, but also just this powerful, powerful fear that, like, if I did anything, I would disappoint my family, my community, my pastor. It's just like, that's a lot to carry, you know? And I don't get into too much in the book. But, I mean, I touch on that obviously, but I also like want to respect my former spouse and my current spouse and everything. But I will just say in general terms, I think that there was a lot I didn't know about myself, right, when I got married. And I think that that's true about a lot of people. And that stuff is kind of hard to figure out when you're already committed and you have sometimes when you already have a mortgage and kids and a life together that you're trying, you know, and some people can and some people can't.
How many purity pledges did you sign?
I don't remember physically signing one, but I had two different purity rings.
Yes, you did.
Yes, I think it's funny, but my first one broke, so make of that what you will. But it was really pretty. It was like, you know, this gold band with a heart made out of fire opal, and fire opal is a really soft stone, so it just fell out a couple times, and we finally went with a different one. But yeah, it was, you know, that was something that was really, and I'm sure like it was for you, it was like just central to the way we talked about relationships and marriage, that like you would basically, you know, your father gives you the purity ring and you hand off your purity to your husband and live happily ever after. That's how it was
Yeah.
supposed to work.
It's an exchange of goods is how I felt. I went from my father's home to my husband's home. I was married at 20. He and I are still married. We'll celebrate 20 years next month, but that is not without a lot of work. He was not raised in faith. I really believe that has been our saving grace, is that he wasn't indoctrinated, because I think had he been indoctrinated, he's a very loyal person. And I think that there's a strong possibility that he would have still continued to stay with that just because of his strong loyalty. Something that I've been talking about a lot, not necessarily online, but just with different people, is how we were not raised to critically think. Critical thinking was being critical. And a critical spirit for a woman was bitterness. So when I entered college, I didn't go to college until my 30s. There was a course, it was a prerequisite, critical thinking and logic. And I literally prayed, Lord, please help me to not develop a bitter spirit while I take this class. Please help me to not become critical and judgmental, because I really believe that. Did you break free of that? How did you become somebody that was not afraid to be a critical thinker?
That's interesting because I think I got really mixed messages about that. In my household, we were really into like apologetics, Christian apologetics. So like we listened to the Bible Answer Man on the radio, if you've ever heard of that. And we had a lot of apologetics books, like initially Josh McDowell and later Lee Strobel. And so there was a real, and my parents were very interested and involved in conservative politics. And so there was a lot of sort of discussion of ideas in my household, I will say. But I felt like quite clearly you were, you know, it was okay to have these sort of discussions, but you were supposed to land, it was clear where you were supposed to land. And I felt that not only from my parents, but from my teachers and so forth too. It was like you ultimately, you know, if you strayed too far afield, people would be really concerned about you. And or you know, I just remember having a lot of questions that people didn't seem like they were able to really answer. And I was a little bit unique. Well, maybe not, but one reality of my childhood, which I talk about quite a bit in the book, is that while my parents were evangelical, deeply committed evangelicals, our extended family wasn't so much. You know, my mother had grown up fairly conservative Lutheran, but it was kind of just, it was much more understated approach to Christianity. My father had grown up very WASPy with parents who were not particularly religious. And his father, my grandfather, is a big character in my book because he was pretty avowedly not religious, not Christian, not an atheist, but just very, he was a man of science. He was a neurosurgeon. He loved to read. He was just not interested in this evangelical Christianity that his son kept pushing on him. And furthermore, as I talk about in the book, he came out as gay in the 80s after my grandmother passed away pretty when she was pretty young, only in her 50s, unfortunately. And so my grandpa had this whole second chapter as a gay man in the 80s with a evangelical fundamentalist son. And it was this really huge tension point in my family. We were always praying for his salvation. We were told we had to be on our best behavior when we went over to his house because we had to model Jesus for him. And I found out later when I found out that he was gay, that was also a big part of the reason we didn't spend much time together, because my parents were worried he would, you know, be a bad influence on us because of his sexuality and his partner. So that created an environment in which I was always aware that there was another point of view, and it was one that had to be contended with and sort of pushed back against. And I think that's probably why we had a lot of these apologetics books in the house, because my parents were trying to shore up, I don't know if they were trying to shore up their own faith or just persuade my grandpa. But like my grandpa would get me books like, I think he got me like Fahrenheit 451 and, you know, sort of try to prompt me to think a little bit. And it was this kind of war of books going back and forth between my dad and his dad. And it was all honestly very uncomfortable. But I think I couldn't avoid critical thinking because I was in that environment where there was so much tension over beliefs.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you to those that have reached out with your support. Whether you have left a review, if you haven't left a review, this would be a really, really good time to leave a review. Read every single one of them. So thank you. And for those that are subscribers to my Patreon, thank you. It means so much. One of the new features that I am adding for my paid Patreon subscribers is the chat feature. And this is just a way that we can all continue this conversation that we're having in the podcast. And if you are not a paid subscriber, unfortunately, the chat feature won't be available to you, but you can be a free subscriber and you'll just get the weekly newsletters. Y'all are amazing. And I honestly could not do this podcast without the support that I receive from each one of you. So thank you so much. I remember having a conversation with my mom. I was probably about 21, and she was telling me how I'd make a really great children's director, or I should look at working with youth group. And I was like, I want to run women's ministry. I was always somebody that wanted to go like, no, I don't understand why I have to be like with kids. I don't want to be with kids. And she said, you just really need to be careful, because I hear you thinking critically about things, and that's going to develop a critical spirit. And you just do not want to take up a bitter root. So you really need to pray that out. And I just kind of, that always just sat so terrible with me, made me feel so uncomfortable. But at the same time, I was like, something's not right.
It's funny. This might be slightly off topic, but you're reminding me that my mom used to quote that verse. Is it in the New Testament? I think that about a woman should have the ornament of a meek and a quiet spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know where it's at, but I would also have that too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, it was a really important message. It was like, it was kind of along the lines of, you know, you said, don't be too critical. Don't develop a critical spirit. I think it was kind of a similar sentiment. Like, as a woman, you should be meek and quiet, submissive, humble, not too loud, not too boisterous. You know, I had a friend in elementary school that was kind of just loud, a loud girl. And I remember, you know, my mother being critical of that. And I think in that context, quoting that verse, just that, you know, the ornament of a meek and a quiet spirit will make you, you know, and it was the phrase was an ornament, like it will make you more, the implicit message is it will make you more attractive and appealing, maybe to men, but to people in general. And I think, you know, going back to your original question about a strong-willed child, I think that might've been some of it. I wasn't a particularly meek or quiet child. I loved to ask questions. I loved books. I loved learning. And, you know, I liked watching documentaries. I was kind of a I was a very dorky kid, you know, and all of that, like I see that in my own kids today, and I think it's great, but, you know, I'm not sure if it aligned particularly with not only the way that a child was supposed to be, but the way a female child was supposed to be.
There were distinct differences, right? My brother was allowed to be loud. He was allowed to challenge. I'd hear this story often. And my mom did talk about how in high school, your brother during biology challenged the teacher because she was teaching evolution. And so he just stood up and he just started challenging her. And we were public schooled, sort of. My sister and brother were 100% public schooled. My mom, depending on her whims, it would be public school and then homeschool with Bob Jones textbooks. So when you start mentioning those, I was just like, oh my goodness, yes.
Did you go in and out of school, or was it like an add-on to your public school?
No, it was, I was public schooled all up until it was the end of seventh grade. So that summer, my parents were like, you know, we just sort of feel like you are not fully living for Jesus. So you're going to be homeschooled. And oh, wow. I was homeschooled from, oh gosh, September of eighth grade. And then I remember winter break, my parents coming into the church. I was at youth group and my dad just said, well, we're done homeschooling you. So you're going to go back to school. And wow. I remember just like running around the church because I was so excited because all my friends were in public school, right? And I didn't really know it at the time, but I wasn't getting an education. I was part of a homeschool co-op. I remember biology just being like, we just looked at plants and marveled at the detail that God created. And like, that was biology. We really didn't learn anything. We just learned, look at how intricate these plants are. Imagine like the way that we are viewing them. Imagine how God views you. It was just like, all right. And then, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I talk about my science textbooks and yeah. which is like, just as a side note to me, the more I've learned about actual science, honestly, it feels spiritual to me. Like
100%.
It's like, wow. I mean, I have a much different view of, I still believe in God and I have a much different view of how that works. You know, I mean, yeah. I don't have a sophisticated view of how God interacts with creation or whatever, but I absolutely accept mainstream evolutionary science. And when I learn about the complexity of it, I'm like, wow. I mean, that is, it feels truly breathtaking to think about the complexity of the world, to understand it. It feels so much more interesting. And to me, even interesting in a spiritual way than being told God just was like, poof, it is what it is, you know?
100%. We had a speech, not speech and debate, just a speech class. It was probably part of like English language arts. And we would stand up in front of the co-op and just give a speech about God. And then they would count the likes and the ums and the ers and the ahs. But we didn't actually learn how to write a speech and then give an appropriate speech. I think that it was just us learning how to tell our testimony when it came down to it. When I'm looking at it in hindsight, I'm thinking that that's what it was. We would pick a topic, relate it to God, and give a speech on it.
That's more extreme than what I experienced. I mean, my curriculum was hit and miss, and I definitely had gaps in my Christian school curriculum, but I also had like an excellent English teacher who thankfully taught us. I mean, I remember learning about like the Robert Frost poem, Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood. And she was like, a lot of Christians want to make this about Christianity. It's not. You know, but, you know, and I'm grateful for that. But I think that's the thing. I mean, it can be very hit and miss in terms of what you learn and what you don't learn, which arguably is true in some public schools too. But that's another conversation.
Yeah. I do find it fascinating. The evangelical movement, I don't know how you frame it. I call it a cult. And there's a different flavor depending on the different denomination. And even inside of those denominations, every church can be different. I was raised non-denominational. So we had a heavy IFB influence along with assemblies of God. So, you know, like I joke and say that we could lift our hands halfway. So we were like carrying a serving tray, but we couldn't go full. You did not go full. And you certainly were judged if you kept your hands down. Do not sit. Unacceptable to sit during worship. We knew that you were basically a Satanist if you sat down. So it was a serving tray. But that's so different.
We went full on hands
you're
up
just, in church. You're full. Yes.
In church, but in school, there were no hands, no hands at all. Because it was that church was a non-denominational charismatic church and school was a Bible church, which is like, it was an independent church, but very similar to Baptist theology and worship. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes my mom would lift her hand almost all the way, but never fully above the head.
Not fully extended.
Absolutely. No airplane. You may not airplane. That was not okay. And no wafting. None of this.
No wafting.
None of this.
I felt like I didn't always feel comfortable with the hand raising in church. And I sometimes felt like I was maybe inadequate because I didn't. No one said anything. No one said anything, to be fair. But, you know, as a young person, you're very sensitive to the atmosphere around you. I was taught that we were all sort of part of the same. We're all Christians, you know, that extended, that terminology extended to anybody who basically had, you know, the same kind of atonement theology that we had. We were very skeptical of Catholics. I remember hearing that some Catholics are Christians. Which is funny if you think about church history, but anyway, and that, you know, mainline Protestants were also questionable, like whether they were sincere or not. And some of them had, you know, this really questionable theology about the Bible and all that. So, but anybody within sort of the spectrum of conservative Christianity, evangelical Christianity was usually considered to be fine. And we understood that there was a range of that. And I think I always say, you know, it's important that to understand that there's a range of views. And like, not all evangelicals are young earth creationists, although I think it's a pretty influential movement within evangelicalism. You know, I went to Focus on the Family's website actually today because I was curious what they're teaching. And you know, there was one article that said something about the fact that some Christians believe it's perfectly acceptable to think that the earth is millions of years old. Others are younger, you know, others believe in creationism. And so there's that. But then they linked to materials that are, you know, they linked to one book that was called like, I think it was called Evolution of Fairy Tale for Adults. So, I mean, these ideas are, there may be some lip service to the idea that you don't have to be a young earth creationist, but I think that that's still a really influential idea.
Yeah. I remember watching Dr. Dino. Do you remember Dr. Dino?
Mm-hmm. No,
I don't remember his name.
I'm a little older than you.
I watched, gosh, in 2005 or 2006, I had a friend that was so excited about it and, oh, you've got to watch Dr. Dino, and just talking about how the earth, you know, only 6,000 years old. And I grew up really believing, oh, this is embarrassing. I really believed that Noah's Ark happened and the flood, and that dinosaurs, the reason why they don't exist anymore is because they were too big to fit on the ark. I believed that into my early 30s, late 20s, early 30s, definitely.
I was taught something like that too.
Yeah. I also really believed that my husband.
I heard something like that. I don't remember who told me, but yeah.
I also really believed that my husband had one less rib than I did all up until my late 20s. So.
And I interviewed somebody who talked about going to nursing school and discovering that wasn't the case and being just humiliated. Yeah.
There's something that you talk about in here, the feeling, or maybe it was her, the feeling of having to fake knowledge to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And how that really plays into imposter syndrome. I think that so many of us coming out of being raised like this, we feel like that. We feel like we have to fake that knowledge. I'll stand in a group of people and they are talking about things that I would have learned had I not been raised this way. And I'm just smiling and nodding. I am thankful. So being raised evangelical, we were raised to be chameleons. We can pretty much fit into any situation really well because we were supposed to figure out how to infiltrate that to share Jesus. This concept of having to consistently fake knowledge is imposter syndrome. Is that something that you still deal with from your upbringing, if you don't mind talking about it?
I still have it. I think that most people who aren't total jerks have imposter syndrome sometimes, especially women, and it's not just evangelical culture. I think like American culture often, you know, especially when we were growing up, I hope it's better now, but I think that when we were growing up still, it was like, it was much more okay for boys to be assertive than girls. And I don't think that that was limited to evangelical culture, but often evangelical culture, I see as trying to hold on to like an earlier time period and resisting modernity in a lot of ways. And so maybe those characteristics are more pronounced partly because of the views of gender roles. But how did I overcome? Well, first of all, how much do I feel that sense of not knowing things I should know? When I was younger, in my 20s, I often felt like I had just missed out on a lot in pop culture and also some of the educational gaps we talked about. Because, you know, while we weren't totally cut off from pop culture, it was very carefully restricted and Christian media was prioritized and, you know, anything else was kind of filtered through a pretty high bar of rules and regulations around what we could watch. So I wasn't supposed to listen to secular music on the radio. I did. I snuck, but I wasn't supposed to.
Of course we did.
I wasn't supposed to go to I don't remember exactly, but I think it was like PG-13 movies I wasn't supposed to go to until I was like in high school or maybe even older. But like, again, the rules would bend a little bit. I had some friends that were less strict and usually my parents would kind of let me like bend the rules if I was at somebody's house. So they weren't as strict as some people I knew who had like, you know, no permission to watch anything. But then there were others who were much less restrictive than ours were. But bottom line was, I felt like, you know, I grew up just, I reached adulthood and realized I'd kind of missed a lot of things. Now I think I've missed a lot of things because I had kids almost right away and I like can't stay awake through a movie anymore. So now I'm like, do I have gaps in my pop cultural knowledge because I was raised evangelical or just because I'm tired?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but yeah, overcoming that, I don't know, I guess, just by doing things that scare me and doing more of them and then things scare you less and less, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about youth group. It's not a main thing in your book, but that's a whole thing. Do you remember crazy youth group games?
Yeah, I think I talked about the White Castle eating contest, didn't I?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and some of that was fun. I have to say, I mostly liked youth group. We went through a few iterations of different leaders. And at one point when I was probably in like 10th grade or so, we landed on a youth leader and his wife that I really liked. And that made all the difference. You know, like they seemed like they really cared about us. They were not super intense about a lot of the stuff that a lot of people were really intense about. Like they didn't put the purity culture stuff front and center. I'm sure they believed in it, but it wasn't like what they highlighted. They, you know, when I remember like one youth leader we had briefly doing those really scary skits about hell, you know, where like
hell, Heaven's Gate, Hell's Fury. Hell, something like that.
Is that the one where like, you know, you're witnessing to your Christian, to your non-Christian friends and they don't believe hell exists. And then basically the whole moral of the story is like people don't believe hell exists and then they get pulled into hell and it's very scary. And
Gates, Hell's Flames. It's a very Pentecostal like Assemblies of God type.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you have human videos?
No. What are those?
So the Lifehouse song, The one that's, you're all I want, you're all I, that one. Okay, so there would be people up on stage and they would be acting that song. And all human videos have one main thing, and that is the female that loves Jesus to begin with and then somehow gets she goes to a party because she starts hanging out with the wrong crowd, you know, public school. And she goes to a party, hangs out with the wrong crowd. She meets a guy who's apparently amazing. They're acting all this. She drinks. She sleeps with him. She gets pregnant. She decides to get an abortion. And then that leads her to a deep, dark depression where she starts using drugs. And then all of a sudden, somehow she has a gun and she's going to kill herself. And then there's a group of people that pull back demons from her. And then Jesus jumps in and he fights the demons for her. That's a human video. They are all the same.
I think I am familiar with this genre, but I didn't realize it was called a human video. And it was a thing that was like iterated in this way. But that's, I feel like I've seen something like that. I'm sure it wasn't a dominant feature of my youth group, but I will say, when I got like upper into high school, maybe like sophomore year-ish, we had some leaders that like would basically just have us over. We'd do a Bible study. It seemed pretty low key. We'd have like a burger eating contest or whatever the silly game was. Definitely had the silly games. And you know, I have pretty positive memories of that, actually.
Yeah, that is very similar to my youth group evolution as well. We had pretty intense youth leaders all up until I was about a junior. And then a new youth pastor and his wife came in and they did not emphasize purity culture. He was more forward thinking and didn't feel like that was appropriate to really force that ideology on girls. I've talked to him since because we've stayed in contact, and I think that he's gone through his own version of deconstructing evangelicalism, especially since 2016, 2020. He told me, he said, I just had a really hard time with telling girls that they had to do specific things, but then watching these boys take advantage of these girls. There was just never an emphasis on teaching boys that consent was important. There was always an emphasis on teaching girls that it's their fault, even if they don't consent. He said, I just couldn't perpetuate that. I couldn't continue pushing that. And do remember the hard stop with purity culture right around the time that I was 17. I had female youth leaders that heavily emphasized that, but he did not. There's a part in your book where you talk about there's a song that your mom is singing, the trust in the Lord with all your heart. I kid you not, Sarah, as soon as I read those lyrics, I heard that song and probably for about an hour. It was just, trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your own understand. Didn't it go like that?
Different tune. Yeah. It was like, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. I think it was an older one, like maybe from the 70s, but you know, it's the same verse. And it's like that verse is like comforting and also upsetting at the same time.
Because exactly.
Being able to trust God is a really comforting feeling. But this idea that you can't lean on your own understanding is hard because then it's like, well, then I always struggled with that. And I think I still do in some ways now. It's like, well, this idea of intellectual humility is really an important one.
Yeah.
But then how do you know if you're hearing from God, so to speak, or how do you know if you're getting it right, especially when it seems like there are for every verse, there are so many different opinions about how to see things. And I sometimes felt like I was not supposed to trust my own gut, my own intuition. Like even when it was very powerful, I was not supposed to rely on that. I was supposed to rely on scripture, but really often that meant like the church's interpretation of scripture. And so, talking again about mixed messages, you know?
At the end, so around, I have it written down as page 171, we're hurting because we followed the rules. And that is a quote from somebody else, if I'm correct.
Yes. My ex-husband.
Yeah.
And I quoted a conversation we had. This was, a couple of years, at least after we got divorced, and we were catching up talking about the kids and this and that. And he gave me permission to quote him, but we were just talking about, the hurting, not because we broke the rules, but because we followed the rules. And I think we thought the rules had set us up for a healthy, happy relationship and family. And for us, in many ways, I think they got in the way. They got in the way of having the kind of connection that we wanted and needed to have. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Moving forward, what is your next project? What are you working on?
Well, I have a day job too.
Yes, you do.
Political correspondent for NPR.
Yes.
So I have, as I've said, kind of accidentally found myself covering religion and politics. I guess I've always been interested in it.
Yeah.
It's become such a big issue the last few years. It's hard to avoid it. And I know something about it from the inside. So I don't just cover that, but I end up doing stories in that space quite a bit. And so I'll be busy these next several months.
Yeah.
Covering the election, the campaign. I am working on another book proposal. I'm not really ready to talk about it in detail yet because I'm still figuring it out. But I think it'll feel like a development from this book in some ways. And in other ways, it'll go a little bit different direction. So I really, really loved the process of writing this book. As a journalist, you file a lot of stories on deadlines, sometimes literally within minutes of something happening. You have to go on the air and talk about it, at least what you know about it. And often, we have a little more time than that, but a long lead time for a typical radio story is weeks, very rarely months, often days. And so I basically wrote this book over the course of a year. I mean, a little bit of it was already written when I wrote the book proposal, but the bulk of it was written over the course of a year. And that was very challenging to fit into my reporting life as well, but it was also really rewarding because just being able to take the time and with each, each chapter deals with a different sort of theme of cognitive dissonance in many ways for a lot of ex-evangelicals, some of the things that propel us to rethink our beliefs. And, it weaves my stories with those of lots of other people and a lot of research as well, as you mentioned. So just having the time to dig into each subject really thoughtfully and talk to multiple people, research it was satisfying. And I look forward to hopefully doing that again, but, in a slightly different vein.
I appreciate how you point out, it's at the end, but you do point out how the ex-evangelical community is, it's great and it's trading in some aspects, if you're not careful, one high control space with another high control space. Mm. I appreciate how you point that out because we're all trying to talk about that. We're all trying to acknowledge that, hey, if we're not careful, this is turning into a cult. I want to switch gears just a little bit. There's three questions that I always ask people, but before I do that, we are moving into an election year. How do those that no longer associate with this faith, but have family that associates with this faith, how do you do family right now?
It can be really challenging. Some people end up not having contact with their families, unfortunately. But if that's the boundary that people need to set, it's so individual to the person and the specific relationships. I grew up with, as I've mentioned, a lot of strain between my family and my grandfather because of his not lack of religious belief and his sexuality. And I never wanted to repeat that, but unfortunately, it's challenging when you have very different ways of seeing the world and when those beliefs for some people in the family are so central to their identity. So my relationships with each person are different. I still have, there's no one that I'm estranged from, which I'm thankful for, and I hope that remains. But varying levels of closeness and intimacy with different people, depending on the specific relationship, right? And I think that tracks with what I've heard from other ex-evangelicals I've interviewed for my book. Some people I describe, my friend Jeff Chu, who's a writer in his own right and a pastor, He talked in the book about his how his relationship with his husband has challenged his parents and their relationship and the really kind of difficult compromises that they've reached to try to maintain a connection. Some people aren't able to make those compromises. I was going to say willing, but I want to say able because I think it's very hard to be told like your partner can't really be in our lives. And, you know, that's for some people, that's an unacceptable compromise. And I have no advice and certainly no judgment for how each person navigates that. I think, you know, we have to take stock of our particular circumstances. But I hope that some parents of ex-evangelicals will read it and at least consider maybe aspects of the experience that they hadn't thought about. I have, and I've been encouraged. I've heard from a few people who fall in that category who are in some cases themselves deconstructing to one degree or another, but really trying to understand what it was that their children, often their adult children, went through. I've heard from a handful of people like that, both once or twice in person at some of my book signings and also, you know, online. And it's wonderful. You know, a couple of people have asked for advice and I don't really give advice, but to the extent that I'm willing to, I've just said, you know, keep listening, keep an open mind and heart and be honest about the fact that you're trying to understand. And I think that that goes a long way with any family relationship.
I agree. I think this is a great book, honestly, for that generation, because there's so many things that they'll be able to connect with when reading. Also, it's going to stir on a conversation, which is so important. Also, you and I share that we worked at a CPC. I worked at a crisis pregnancy. I think that it's just something that you just check off.
Bingo card.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I ask people, what is your favorite book? What is your favorite movie? And then what is currently your favorite song? Because for me, I can't pick a favorite song. That's like choosing a favorite child. So,
oh yeah, I'm the same way. I'm actually kind of probably the same way about books and movies.
Yeah. Obviously, aside from your own book, what is your favorite book?
Okay. Oh, that's really hard. I'm honestly the same way about books as I am about music. Like it's kind of whatever I'm reading at the time.
What is your most film that you have read in the last 2 months? What has?
Well, I'm in the midst of reading right now, Carl Sagan's The Demon Haunted World. And I'm not going to say it's my favorite book because it's not, but because I haven't read enough of it yet, but his prose is so beautiful. And I feel like the two categories of things of learning that I love to do now is like post deconstruction is around science. Mm-hmm. Because I used to be afraid of it. I used to be afraid I would learn something that would threaten my faith. And I'm not afraid of that now. And I actually feel just so inspired, especially by the way that Carl Sagan talks about science. So that's one. And then I love history of religion. I'm just fascinated by like how different religious movements have interacted and sadly often violently interacted. But it's, I think it puts this little sliver of Christian history and human history in perspective to learn more about kind of where it all came from. So I recently read, and I've talked about this in other interviews, but it's just been on my mind a lot. Strange Gods by Susan Jacoby, which is a history. It's called a history of conversion, a secular history of conversion, but it's really mostly about forced conversion. And it's mostly about Christianity, but it's also a little bit about Islam and touches on Judaism, although Judaism doesn't really have a history of seeking converts. So it's less talked about. But, you know, gets into the violent history of, you know, Catholicism versus Protestantism and vice versa, and Islam versus Christianity and vice versa. And it's all very sad and dire, but it's kind of an important perspective, I think, especially when we're at a moment in our own American history where we're thinking a lot about the intersection between religion and politics and church and state. Mm-hmm. It's good to have some much larger perspective on how that has gone in the past. I'll just say one more. I've always appreciated the writing of Anne Lamott around parenting and around spirituality. Several of her books I like, read them a long time ago, but that was at a time when I was kind of still coming to terms with the idea that you could have a Christian spirituality that didn't look the way I had been raised to think it did. So her book, what's it called? Operating Instructions, I think, about her first year of her son's life is really beautiful. And other works by Anne Lamott. That's books. That's way more than one book. Movies. One of my very favorite movies is The Station Agent. It's got Patricia Clarkson is in it, Peter Dinklage. It's just this kind of obscure, weird little movie, but it's about three people who are all in their own way kind of outsiders and hurting, and how they kind of find each other and build community and connection, which to me is a very human story. Michelle Williams is in it too, actually. And favorite song.
A song that really speaks to you right now that you could listen to two or three times in a row. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think one of my favorite songs, like deconstruction songs, so I'll just mention that, is Broken Horses by Brandi Carlile on, I think it was on her most recent album, like 2020-ish. I'm going to get that wrong. It just talks about, Brandi Carlile has a religious background, and I think the way I hear that in a lot of her writing, and some of it seems to be around complicated relationships with faith, but some of it also seems really honoring of faith. And I appreciate that. It's from her 2021 album, In These Silent Days.
I will have to look that up. I haven't listened to that song. I'm in the process of writing a book as well, and I have a full playlist. It definitely includes some of the songs that we listened to in the 90s, Jars of Clay, DC Talk, mm-hmm. all of that, because I'm trying to be in the mind of trying to get in that mindset.
That whole album is good, I have to say, that Brandi Carlile album. Broken Horses is good when you're kind of angry. Let's see. Oh, You and Me on the Rock is a very sweet love song. There's a lot of good stuff. Anyway.
I'll have to check it out. Thank you so much. I know you've got a plane to catch. Thank you so much for taking the time. Y'all need to go read The Exvangelicals. She also has it on Audible. Please go on Goodreads and leave a review. That is how you can support authors. Obviously, purchasing their book, listening to their book, that sort of thing. Please go leave reviews because it's so important.
Thank you.
I can't leave you without saying this, that your grandpa would be so proud of you. So proud of you. He seems like he was a lovely man and would sacrifice so much for you and to see you happy. Thank you for sharing him in your book with us.
Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thank you so much for listening. Please make sure that you are kind to yourself and to others. If you are interested in supporting this show, please click the link at the bottom to my Patreon. These shows take a lot of time and resources, and any support is appreciated. If you are interested in being a guest, please email the show at focusonyourownfamilypodcast@gmail.com. Inside of the show notes, you will find the links to mine and the guests' socials. Please give us a follow. We look forward to talking with you and connecting with you.